dig because I'm handy, and I said I'd do it. There's not going to be any fairy tale reward once we get Kitty back from her ex. I'll be lucky to get a handshake. So why am I doing it? I'll lay it out straight. I'm bored. I've got a head that never stops working. I'm always considering the percentages, making plans. When I said I'd come to enjoy driving a cab, I was telling the truth, I do. But you're talking to a guy who spent the better part of his life working out deals. And when the deals didn't pan out, he just went in and took what he needed. That's what put me inside. They don't put a whole lot of innocent people in jail. I'm not saying they aren't biased towards what most people think of as the dregs of society, the homeboys and Indians and white trash I was raised to be. But most of us doing our time, we did the crime. Creeping some stranger's house gives me a buzz like a junkie getting a fix. I don't get the shakes when I go cold turkey, like I've been doing these past couple of months. But the Jones is still there. Tonight I'm just cozying it up with a sugar coating of doing the shiny white knight bit, that's all. I never even stopped to ask her why we were stealing a cat. I just thought, let's do it. But when you think about it, who steals cats? You lose your cat, you just go get another one. We never had pets when I was a kid. So maybe that's why I don't get it. In our house, the kids were the pets. Only we weren't so well treated as I guess Louisa's cat is. Somebody ever took one of us. The only thing Maud regret is the cut in her check from social services. You want another reason? I don't often get a chance to hang out with a pretty girl like this. So, what's the plan? I ask.
The man who lives in that house is very powerful,
Louisa says. Your ex. She nods. So he's what? A politician? A lawyer? A drug dealer?
No. No. Much more powerful than that. He's a brujo. A witch man. That is not a wrong thing in itself, but his medicine is very bad. He is an evil man.
I give her the same blank look I'm guessing anybody would.
I can see you don't believe me,
she says. It's more like I don't understand, I tell her.
It doesn't matter. I tell you this only so that you won't look into his eyes. No matter what, do not meet his gaze with your own.
Or what? He'll turn me into a pumpkin?
Something worse,
she says in all seriousness. She gets out of the car before I can press her on it, but I'm not about to let it go. I get out my side and join her on the sidewalk. She takes my hand and leads me quickly into the shadows cast by a tall hedge that runs the length of the property, separating her ex's house from its neighbors. I like the feel of her skin against mine. She lets go all too soon. What's really going on here? I ask her. I mean, I pick you up outside a girl bar on Gracie Street where you're dressed like a hooker. And now we're about to creep some magic guy's house to get your cat back. None of this is making a whole lot of sense.
And yet, you are here.
I give her a slow nod. Maybe I should never have looked in your eyes, I say. I'm joking, but she's still all seriousness when she answers.
I would never do such a thing to another human being,
she tells me.
Yes, I went out looking the way I did in hopes of attracting a man such as you, but there was no magic involved.
I focus on the "a man such as you." Not sure I like what it says about what she thinks of me. I may not look like much, which translates into a lot of nights spent on my own, but I've never paid for it. You looked like a prostitute, trying to pick up a John or some freak. She actually smiles, her teeth flashing in the shadows, white against her dark skin.
No, I was searching for a man who would desire me enough to want to be close to me, but who had the heart to listen to my story, and the compassion to want to help once he knew the trouble I was in.
I think you've got the wrong guy, I tell her. Neither of those are things I'm particularly known for.
And yet you are here,
she says again.
And you shouldn't sell yourself short. Sometimes we don't fulfill our potential only because there is no one in our life to believe in us.
I've got an idea where she's going with that. Hank and Moth have talked about that kind of thing some nights when we're sitting around a campfire in the junkyard. Not to mention every damn social worker who's actually trying to do their job. But I don't want to go there with her any more than I do with them. It's a nice theory, but I've never bought it. Your life doesn't go a certain way just because other people think that's the way it will. You were taking a big chance, I say instead. You could have picked up some freak with a knife who wasn't going to stop to listen. She shakes her head.
No one would have troubled me.
But you need my help with your ex.
That is different. I have looked in his eyes. He has sewn black threads in my soul, and without a champion at my side, I'm afraid he would pull me back under his influence.
This I understand. I've helped a couple of women get out of a bad relationship by pounding a little sense into their ex-boyfriend's head. It's amazing how the threat of more of the same is so much more effective than a restraining order. So you're looking for some muscle to pound on your ex.
I'm hoping that won't be necessary. You wouldn't want him for an enemy.
Some people say you're judged by your enemies.
Then you would be considered a powerful man too,
she says. So the get-up you had on was like a costume. She nods, but even in the shadows I can see the bitter look that comes into her eyes.
I have many costumes such as that,
she says.
My boyfriend insists I wear them in order to appear attractive. He likes it that men would desire me but could not have me.
Boy, what planet is he from, I say. You could wear a burlap sack and you'd still be drop-dead gorgeous.
You did not like the dress?
I shrug. What can I say? I'm a guy. Of course I liked it. I'm just saying you don't need it.
You are very sweet.
Again with the making nice. Funny thing is, I don't want to argue it with her anymore. I find I like the idea that someone would say these kinds of things to me. But I don't pretend there's a hope in hell that it'll ever go past this. Instead, I focus on the holes in her story. There are things she isn't telling me, and I say as much. But while she can't help but look a little guilty, she doesn't share them either. Look, I tell her, it doesn't matter what they are. I just need to know. Are they going to get in the way of our getting the job done?
I don't think so.
I wait a moment, but she's still playing those cards pretty much as close to her vest as she can. I wonder how many of them are wild. Okay, I say. So we'll just do it. But we need to make a slight detour first. Do you think your cat can hold out for another hour or so? She nods. She doesn't ask any questions when I pull up behind a plant nursery over on East Kelly Street. I jimmy the lock on the back door like it's not even there. Hey, it's what I do. Or at least used to do, and slip inside. It takes me a moment to track down what I'm looking for, using the beam of a cheap keyring flashlight to read labels. Finally, I find the shelf I need. I cut a hole in a small bag of diatomaceous earth and carefully pour a bit of it into each of my jacket's pockets. When I replace the bag, I leave a 5-spot on the shelf beside it as payment. See, I'm learning. Guys back in prison would be laughing their asses off if they ever heard about this. But I don't care. I may still bust into some guy's house to help his ex-girlfriend steal back her cat, but I'm done with taking what I haven't earned. You figure he's home? I ask when we pull back up outside the house on Merritt. She nods.
He would not leave her alone, not so soon after stealing her from me.
You know where his bedroom is?
At the back of the house, on the second floor. He is a light sleeper.
Of course he would be. And your cat, I say. Would she have the run of the house, or would he keep her in a cage?
He would have other methods of keeping her docile.
The magic eyes business.
His power is not a joking matter,
she says. I'm taking it seriously, I tell her. Though I'm drawing the line at magic. Thing is, I know guys who can do things with their eyes. You see it in prison all the time. Whole conversations taking place without a word being exchanged. It's all in the eyes. Some guys are like a snake, mesmerizing its prey. The eyes lock onto you, and before you know what's going on, he's stuck a shiv in your gut, and you're down on the floor, trying to keep your life from leaking out of you, your own blood pouring over your hands. But I'm pretty good with the 1,000-yard stare myself. I get out of the car, and we head for the side door in the carport. I'd have had Louisa stay behind in the cab, Except I figure her cat's going to be a lot more docile if she's there to carry it back out again. I give the door a visual check for an alarm. There's nothing obvious, but that doesn't mean anything. So I ask Louisa about it.
A man such as he does not need a security system,
she tells me. The magic thing again. When she nods, I shrug and take a couple of pairs of surgical gloves out of my back pocket. I hand her one pair and put the other on, then get out my picks. This door takes a little longer than the one behind the nursery did. For a guy who's got all these magic chops, he's still sprung for a decent lock. That makes me feel a little better. I'm not saying that Louisa's gullible or anything, but with guys like this, doesn't matter what scam they're running, magic mumbo-jumbo is not a whole lot different from the threat of a beating. It's the fear factor that keeps people in line. All you need is for your victim to believe that you can do what you say you'll do if they don't toe the line. You don't actually need magic. The lock gives up with a soft click. I put my picks away and take out a small can of W-30, spraying each of the hinges before I let the door swing open. Then I lean close to Louisa, my mouth almost touching her ear. Where should we start looking? I say. My voice is so soft you wouldn't hear me a few steps away. She replies as quietly, her breath warm against my ear. This close to her, I realize that a woman like her smells just as good as she looks. That's something I just never had the opportunity to learn before.
The basement,
Louisa says.
If she is not hiding from him there, then he will have her in his bedroom with him. There is a door leading downstairs just past that cupboard.
I nod and start for the door she pointed to, my sneakers silent on the tiled floor. Louisa whispers along behind me. I do the hinges on this door, too, and I'm cautious on the steps going down, putting my feet close to the sides of the risers where they're less liable to wake a creak. There was a light switch at the top of the stairs. Once I get to the bottom, I stand silent, listening. There's nothing. I feel along the wall and come across the other switch I was expecting to find. Close your eyes, I tell Louisa. I do the same thing and flick the switch. There's a blast of light behind my closed lids. I crack them slightly and take a quick look around. The basement is furnished, casually, like an upscale rec room. There's an entertainment center against one wall, a wet bar against another. Nice couch set up in front of the TV. I count three doors, all of them slightly ajar. I'm not sure what they lead to. Furnace room, laundry room, workshop, who knows? By the time I'm finished looking around, my eyes have adjusted to the light. The one thing I don't see is a cat. You want to try calling her? I ask. Louisa shakes her head.
I can feel her. She is hiding in there.
She points to one of the mystery doors.
In the storage room.
I let her go ahead of me, following after. Better the cat see her first than my ugly mug. We're halfway across the room when someone speaks from behind us.
I knew you would return,
a man's voice says, speaking in Spanish.
And look what you have brought me, a peace offering.
I turn slowly, not letting on that I know what he said. I picked up a lot of Spanish on the street, more in jail. So I just look surprised, which isn't a stretch. I can't believe I didn't feel him approach. When I'm creeping a joint, I carry a sixth sense inside me that stretches out throughout the place, letting me know when there's a change in the air. Hell, I should at least have heard him on the stairs.
I have brought you nothing,
Louisa says, speaking English for my benefit, I guess.
And yet I will have you and your champion. I will make you watch as I strip away his flesh and sharpen my claws on his bones.
Please, I ask only for our freedom.
You can never be free from me.
I have to admit he's a handsome devil. Same dark hair and complexion as Louisa. But there's no warmth in his eyes. Oh, I know what Louisa said. Don't look in his eyes. But the thing is, I don't play that game. You learn pretty quickly when you're inside that the one thing you don't do is back down. Show even a hint of weakness and your fellow inmates will be on you like piranha. So I just put a hand in the pocket of my jacket and look him straight in the eye, give him my best convict stare. He smiles.
You are a big one, aren't you? He says. But your size means nothing in this game we will play.
You ever get into a staring contest? I can see that starting up here. Except Dark Eyes figures he's going to mesmerize me in seconds, he's so confident. The funny thing is, I can feel a pull in that gaze of his. His pupils seem to completely fill my sight. I hear a strange whispering in the back of my head, and can feel that thousand-yard stare of mine already starting to fray at the edges. So maybe he's got some kind of magical power. I don't know, and I don't care. I take my hand out of my pocket, and I'm holding a handful of that diatomaceous earth I picked up earlier in the nursery. Truth is, I never thought I'd use it. I picked it up as a backup, nothing more. Like insurance, just in case, crazy as it sounded, Louisa really knew what she was talking about. I mean, you hear stories about every damn thing you can think of. I never believed most of what I heard. But a computer is like magic to someone who's never seen one before, you know what I'm saying? The world's big enough and strange enough that pretty much anything can be out there in it, somewhere. So, I've got that diatomaceous earth in my hand and I throw it right in his face, because I'm panicking a little at the way those eyes of his are getting right into my head and starting to shut me down inside. You know anything about that stuff? It's made of ground-up shells and bones that are sharp as glass. Gardeners use it to make barriers for various kinds of insects. The bug crawls over it and gets cut to pieces. It's incredibly fine, so much so that it doesn't come through the latex of my gloves. But eyes don't have that kind of protection. Imagine what it would do if it got in them. Tall, dark, and broody over there doesn't have to use his imagination. He lifts his hand as the cloud comes at him, but he's too late. Too late to wave it away. Too late to close his eyes like I've done as I back away from any contact with the stuff. His eyelids instinctively do what they're supposed to do in a situation like this. They blink rapidly, and the pressure cuts his eyes all to hell and back again. It doesn't help when he reaches up with his hands to try to wipe the crap away. He starts to make this horrible mewling sound and falls to his knees. I'm over by the wall now, well out of range of the rapidly settling cloud. Looking at him, I start to feel a little queasy, thinking I did an overkill on this. I don't know what went on between him and Louisa, how bad it got, what kind of punishment he deserves, but I think maybe I crossed a line here that I really shouldn't have. He lifts his bloodied face, sightless eyes pointed in our direction, and manages to say something else. This time he's talking in some language I never heard before, ending with some Spanish that I do understand.
"Be so forever," he cries.
I'm turning to Louisa just then, so I see what happens. Well, I see it, but it doesn't register as real. One moment there's this beautiful dark-haired woman standing there. Then she vanishes, and there's only the heap of her clothes left lying on the carpet. I'm still staring slack-jawed when the clothing moves, and a sleek black cat wriggles out from under the overalls and darts into the room where Louisa said her cat was. As I take a step after her, the man starts in with something else in that unrecognizable language. I don't know if it's still aimed at Louisa, or if he's planning to turn me into something too. Hell, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool believer at this point. But I don't take any chances. I take a few quick steps in his direction and give him a kick in the side of the head. When that doesn't completely stop him, I give him a couple more. He finally goes down and stays down. I turn back to go after Louisa, but before I can, that black cat comes soft-stepping out of the room once more, this time carrying a kitten in its mouth. "Louisa?" I find myself saying. I swear even with that kitten in its mouth the cat nods, but I don't even need to see that. I only have to look into her eyes. The cat has Louisa's eyes. There's no question in my mind about that. "Is this permanent?" I ask. The cat's response is to trot by me, giving her unconscious ex's body a wide berth as she heads for the stairs. I stand there, looking at the damage I've done to her ex for a long, unhappy moment. Then I follow her up the stairs. She's sitting by the door with the kitten, but I can't leave it like this. I look around the kitchen, not ready to leave yet. The cat makes a querulous sound, but I ask her to wait and go prowling through the house. I don't know what I'm looking for. Something to justify what I did downstairs, I guess. I don't find anything, not really. There are spooky masks and icons and other weird magical-looking artifacts scattered throughout the house. But he's not going to be the first guy that likes to collect that kind of thing. Nothing explains why he needed to have this hold over Louisa and her. I'm not thinking of the kitten as a cat anymore. After what I saw downstairs, I'm sure it's her kid. I go upstairs and poke through his office, his bedroom. Still nothing. But then it's often like that. Too often the guy you'd never suspect of having a bad thought turns out to beating on his family, or goes postal where he works, or some damn crazy thing. It really makes you wonder, especially with a guy like Luis's ex. You find yourself with power like he's got. Why wouldn't you use it to put something good into the world? I know, look who's talking. But I'm telling you straight, I might have robbed a lot of people, but I never hurt them, not intentionally, and never a woman or a kid. I go back downstairs and find the cat still waiting by the kitchen door for me. She's got a paw on the kitten holding it in place. Let's go, I say. I haven't even started to think about how a woman can be changed into a cat, or when and if and how she'll change back again. I can only deal with one thing at a time. My first impulse is to burn the place to the ground with him in it, but playing the cowboy like that's just going to put me back inside, and it won't prove anything. I figure I've done enough damage, and it's not like he's going to call the cops. But the first thing I'm going to do when I get home is change the plates on the cab, and dig out the spare set of registration papers that Moth provides for all his vehicles. For now, I follow the cats down the driveway. I open the passenger door to the cab. The mama cat grabs her kitten by the skin at the nape of her neck and jumps in. I close the door and walk around to the driver's side. I take a last look at the house, remembering the feel of the guy's eyes inside my head. The relief I felt when the diatomaceous earth got in his eyes and cut them all to hell. There was a lot of blood, but I don't know how permanent the damage will be. Maybe he'll come after us, but I doubt it. 9 out of 10 times. A guy like that just folds his hand when someone stands up to him. Besides, the city's so big, he's never going to find us, even if he does come looking. It's not like we run in the same circles or anything. So I get in the cab, say something that I hope sounds calming to the cats, and we drive away. I've got a different place now, a one-bedroom, ground-floor apartment which gives me access to a backyard. It's not much, just a jungle of weeds and flowers gone wild, but the cats seem to like it. I sit on the back step sometimes and watch them romp around like, well, like the cats they are, I guess. I know I hurt the man who had them under his power, hurt him bad, and I know I walked into his house with a woman and came out with a cat, but it still feels like a dream. It's true the cat seems to understand everything I say, and acts smarter than I think a cat would normally act, but what do I know? I never had a pet before. And anybody I talk to seems to think the same thing about their own cat or dog. I haven't told anybody about any of this, though I did come at it from a different angle, sitting around the fire in the junkyard with Hank one night. There were a half dozen of us, Moth, Hank's girlfriend Lily, and some of the others from their extended family of choice. The junkyard's in the middle of the city, but it backs onto the tombs and it gets dark out there. As we sit in deck chairs, nursing beers and coffees, we watch the sparks flicker above the flames in the cut-down steel barrel Moth uses for his fires. "Did you ever hear any stories about people that can turn into animals?" I ask, during a lull in the conversation. We have those kinds of talks. We can go from carbs and engine torques to what's wrong with social services or the best kind of herbal tea for nausea. That'd be ginger tea.
"You mean like a werewolf?"
Moth says. Sitting beside him, Paris grins. She's as dark-haired as Louisa was, and her skin's pretty much covered with tattoos that seem to move on their own in the flickering light.
"Nah,"
she says.
"Billy Joe's just looking for a way to turn himself into a raccoon or a monkey, so he can get into houses again but without getting caught.
I gave that up, I tell her. She smiles at me, eyes still teasing.
I know that, but I still like the picture it puts in my head.
There are all kinds of stories, Hank says, and we know one or two. The way they go, the animal people were here first, and some of them are still living among us, not looking any different from you or me. They tell a few then, Hank and Lily and Katie, this pretty red-haired girl who lives on her own in a school bus not far from the junkyard. They all tell the stories like they've actually met the people they're talking about, but Katie's are the best. She's got the real storyteller's gift, makes you hang on to every word until she's done. But what about if someone's put a spell on someone, I say after a few of their stories, because they're mostly about people who were born that way, part animal, part human, changing their skins as they please. You know any stories like that? How it works? How they get changed back? I've got a lot of people looking at me after I come out with that. Nobody has an answer. Moth gives me a look, but it's curious, not demanding.
Why are you asking?
He says. I just shrug. I don't know that it's my story to tell. But as the weeks go by, I bring it up again, and this time I tell them what happened. Or at least what I think happened. Funny thing is, they just take me at my word. They start looking in on it for me, but nobody comes up with an answer. Maybe there isn't one. So I just drive my cab and spend time with these new families of mine, both the one in the junkyard and the cats I've got back home. I find it gets easier to walk the straight and narrow the longer you do it. Gets so that doing the right thing, the honest thing, comes like second nature to me. But I never stop wondering about what happened that night. I don't even know if they're really cats who were pretending to be human, or humans that got turned into cats. I guess I'm always going to be waiting to see if they'll change back. But I don't think about it 24/7. Mostly, I just figure it's my job to make a home for them and keep them safe. And you know what? Turns out I'm pretty good at doing that. Not Waving. Michael Marshall Smith.
Michael Marshall Smith is a best-selling novelist and screenwriter, writing under several different names, including Michael Marshall. His first novel, Only Forward, won the August Derleth and Philip K. Dick Awards. Spares and One of Us were optioned for film by DreamWorks and Warner Brothers. And the Straw Men trilogy, The Straw Men, The Lonely Dead, and Blood of Angels, were international bestsellers. His Steel Dagger-nominated novel, The Intruders, is currently in series development with the BBC. Smith is also a three-time winner of the British Fantasy Award for short fiction, and his stories are collected in two volumes, What You Make It and More Tomorrow and Other Stories, which won the International Horror Guild Award. His most recent novels are Bad Things and The Servants, a short novel published under the new pseudonym M.M. Smith. Not Waving is a story about love, guilt, and the choices that sometimes trap us. Smith comments on the story's most unusual and one of its most painful aspects. I wrote about bulimia because a friend of mine was a sufferer, though I stress she bore no relationship whatsoever to the character in the story. I guess I wanted to try to capture the strange combination of strength and weakness that the condition seems to confer on people, without making it the sole focus of the story. Not least because that combination of strength and weakness is in all of us. Also, that it is the condition of which one appears to be trapped, much like the relationship of the narrator.
Sometimes we're in a car, driving country roads in autumn. I see sparse poppies splashing among the grasses, and it makes me want to cut my throat and let the blood spill out of the window to make more poppies, many more, until the roadside is a blaze of red. Instead, I light a cigarette and watch the road, and in a while the poppies will be behind us, as they always are. On the morning of 10th October, I was in a state of reasonably high excitement. I was at home, and I was supposed to be working. What I was mainly doing, however, was sitting thrumming at my desk, leaping to my feet whenever I heard the sound of traffic outside the window. When I wasn't doing that, I was peeking at the two large cardboard boxes that were sitting in the middle of the floor. The two large boxes contained, respectively, a new computer and a new monitor. After a year or so of containing my natural wire-headed need to own the brightest and best in high-specification consumer goods, I'd finally succumbed and upgraded my machine. Credit card in hand, I'd picked up the phone and ordered myself a piece of science fiction in the shape of a computer that not only went like a train, but also had built-in telecommunications and speech recognition. The future was finally here, and sitting on my living room floor. However, while I had £3,000 worth of Mac and monitor, what I didn't have was the 15-pound cable that connected the two together. The manufacturer, it transpired, felt it constituted an optional extra, despite the fact that without it, the two system components were little more than bulky white ornaments of a particularly tantalizing and frustrating kind. The cable had to be ordered separately, and there weren't any in the country at the moment. They were all in Belgium. I was only told this a week after I ordered the system, and I strove to make my feelings on the matter clear to my supplier. During the further week in which they playfully promised to deliver the system first one day, then another, all such promises evaporating like the morning dew. The two boxes had finally made it to my door the day before, and, by a bizarre coincidence, the cables had today crawled tired and overwrought into the supplier's warehouse. My contact at Corhaven Direct knew just how firmly one of those cables had my name on it, and had phoned to grudgingly admit they were available. I'd immediately called my courier firm, which I occasionally used to send design roughs to clients. Corhaven had offered, but I somehow sensed that they wouldn't quite get round to it today, and I'd waited long enough. The bike firm I used specializes in riders, who looked as if they'd been chucked out of the Hell's Angels for being too tough. A large man in leathers turning up in Corhaven's offices, with instructions not to leave without my cable, was just the sort of incentive I felt they needed. And so I was waiting, drinking endless cups of coffee, for such a person to arrive at the flat, brandishing said component above his head in triumph. When the buzzer finally went, I nearly fell off my chair. The entry phone in our building was fashioned with waking the dead in mind, and I swear the walls vibrate. Without bothering to check who it was, I left the flat and pounded down the stairs to the front door, swinging it open with, I suspect, a look of joy upon my face. I get a lot of pleasure out of technology. It's a bit sad, I know. God knows Nancy has told me so often enough. But hell, it's my life. Standing on a step was a leather convention, topped with a shining black helmet. The biker was a lot slighter than their usual type, but quite tall. Tall enough to have done the job, evidently. "Bloody marvelous," I said. "Is that a cable?"
"Sure is,"
the biker said indistinctly. A hand raised a visor on the helmet, and I saw with some surprise that it was a woman.
"They didn't seem too keen to let it go."
I laughed and took the package from her. Sure enough, it said AV adapter cable on the outside. "You've made my day," I said a little wildly. "And I'm more than tempted to kiss you."
"That seems rather forward,"
the girl said, reaching up to her helmet.
"But a cup of coffee would be nice. I've been driving since 5 this morning and my tongue feels like it's made of brick."
Slightly taken aback, I hesitated for a moment. I'd never had a motorcycle courier in for tea before. Also, it meant a delay before I could ravage through the boxes and start connecting things up. But it was still only 11 in the morning, and another 15 minutes wouldn't harm. I was also, I guess, a little pleased at the thought of such an unusual encounter. "You would be," I said with Arthurian courtliness, "most welcome."
"Thank you, kind sir,"
the courier said, and pulled her helmet off. A great deal of dark brown hair spilled out around her face, and she swung her head to clear it. Her face was strong, with a wide mouth and vivid green eyes that had a smile already in them. The morning sun caught chestnut gleams in her hair as she stood with extraordinary grace on the doorstep. Bloody hell, I thought, the cable unregarded in my hand. Then I stood to one side to let her into the house. It turned out her name was Alice, and she stood looking at the books on the shelves as I made a couple of cups of coffee.
"Your girlfriend's in personnel,"
she said. "How did you guess?" I said, handing her a cup. She indicated the raft of books on human resource development and stating the bleeding obvious in 5 minutes a day, which take up half our shelves.
"You don't look the type. Is this it?"
She pointed her mug at the two boxes on the floor. I nodded sheepishly.
"Well,"
she said,
"aren't you going to open them?"
I glanced up at her, surprised. Her face was turned toward me, a small smile at the corners of her mouth. Her skin was the pale, tawny color that goes with rich hair, I noticed, and flawless. I shrugged, slightly embarrassed. "I guess so," I said noncommittally. "I got some work I ought to do first."
"Rubbish,"
she said firmly.
"Let's have a look."
And so I bent down and pulled open the boxes, while she settled down on the sofa to watch. What was odd was that I didn't mind doing it. Normally, when I'm doing something that's very much to do with me and the things I enjoy, I have to do it alone. Other people seldom understand the things that give you the most pleasure. And I, for one, would rather not have them around to undermine the occasion. But Alice seemed genuinely interested, and 10 minutes later I had the system sitting on the desk. I pressed a button, and the familiar tone rang out as the machine set about booting up. Alice was standing to one side of me, sipping the remains of her coffee, and we both took a startled step back at the vibrancy of the tone ringing from the monitor stereo speakers. In the meantime, I'd babbled about voice recognition and video output, the half-gigabyte hard disk and CD-ROM. She'd listened and even asked questions, questions that followed from what I was saying, rather than to simply set me up to drivel on some more. It wasn't that she knew a vast amount about computers. She just understood what was exciting about them. When the screen threw up the standard message saying all was well, we looked at each other.
"You're not going to get much work done today, are you?"
she said. "Probably not," I agreed. Then she laughed. Just then a protracted squawking noise erupted from the sofa, and I jumped. The courier rolled her eyes and reached over to pick up her unit. A voice of stunning brutality informed her that she had to pick something up from the other side of town urgently, like 5 minutes ago. And why wasn't she there already, darling?
"Grr,"
she said, like a little tiger, and reached for her helmet.
"Duty calls."
"But I haven't told you about the telecommunications yet," I said, joking.
"Some other time,"
she said. I saw her out, and we stood for a moment on the doorstep. I was wondering what to say. I didn't know her, and would never see her again, but wanted to thank her for sharing something with me. Then I noticed one of the local cats ambling past the bottom of the steps. I love cats, but Nancy doesn't, so we don't have one. Just one of the little compromises you make, I guess. I recognized this particular cat, and had long since given up hope of appealing to it. I pointlessly made the sound universally employed for gaining cats' attention, with no result. It glanced up at me wearily, and then continued to cruise on by. After a look at me, Alice sat down on her heels and made the same noise. The cat immediately stopped in its tracks and looked at her. She made the noise again, and the cat turned, glanced down the street for no apparent reason, and then confidently made its way up the steps to weave in and out of her legs. "That is truly amazing," I said. "He is not a friendly cat." She took the cat in her arms and stood up.
"Oh, I don't know,"
she said. The cat sat up against her chest, looking around benignly. I reached out to rub its nose and felt the warm vibration of a purr. The two of us made a fuss of him for a few moments, and then she put him down. She replaced her helmet, climbed on her bike, and then, with a wave, set off. Back in the flat, I tidied away the boxes, anal retentive that I am, before settling down to immerse myself in the new machine. On impulse, I called Nancy to let her know the system had finally arrived. I got one of her assistants instead. She didn't put me on hold, and I heard Nancy say,
"Tell him I'll call him back,"
in the background. I said goodbye to Trish with fairly good grace, trying not to mind. Voice recognition software hadn't been included, it turned out, nor anything to put in the CD-ROM drive. The telecommunications functions wouldn't work without an expensive add-on, which Corehaven didn't expect for 4 to 6 weeks. Apart from that, it was great. Nancy cooked that evening. We tended to take it in turns, though she was much better at it than me. Nancy is good at most things, She's accomplished. There's a lot of infighting in the world of personnel, it would appear, and Nancy was in feisty form that evening, having outmaneuvered some co-worker. I drank a glass of red wine and leaned against the counter while she whirled ingredients around. She told me about her day, and I listened and laughed. I didn't tell her much about mine, only that it had gone okay. Her threshold for hearing about the world of freelance graphic design was pretty low. She'd listen with relatively good grace if I really had to get something out of my system, but she didn't understand it, and didn't seem to want to. No reason why she should, of course. I didn't mention the new computer sitting on my desk, and neither did she. Dinner was very good. It was chicken, but she'd done something intriguing to it with spices. I ate as much as I could, but there was a little left. I tried to get her to finish it, but she wouldn't. I reassured her that she hadn't eaten too much, in the way that sometimes seemed to help. But her mood dipped, and she didn't have any dessert. I steered her toward the sofa and took the stuff out to wash up and make some coffee. While I was standing at the sink, scrubbing the plates and thinking vaguely about the mountain of things I had to do the next day, I noticed a cat sitting on a wall across the street. It was a sort of very dark brown color, almost black, and I hadn't seen it before. It was crouched down, watching a twittering bird with that catty concentration that combines complete attention with the sense that they might at any moment break off and wash their foot instead. The bird eventually fluttered chaotically off, and the cat watched it for a moment before sitting upright, as if drawing a line under that particular diversion. Then the cat's head turned, and it looked straight at me. It was a good 20 yards away, but I could see its eyes very clearly. It kept looking, and after a while I laughed, slightly taken aback. I even looked away for a moment, but when I looked back it was still there, still looking. The kettle boiled and I turned to tip water into a couple of mugs of Nescafe. When I glanced out the window on the way out of the kitchen, the cat was gone. Nancy wasn't in the lounge when I got there, so I settled on the sofa and lit a cigarette. After about 5 minutes the toilet flushed upstairs, and I sighed. My reassurances hadn't done any good at all. A couple of days came and went, with the usual flurry of deadlines and redrafts. I went to a social evening at Nancy's office and spent a few hours being ignored and patronized by her power-dressed colleagues, while she stood and sparkled in the center. I messed up a print job, and had to cover the cost of doing it again. Good things happened too, I guess, but it's the others that stick in your mind. One afternoon, the buzzer went, and I wandered absent-mindedly downstairs to get the door. As I opened it, I saw a flick of brown hair, and saw that it was Alice. "Hello there," I said, strangely pleased.
"Hello yourself," she smiled. "Got a parcel for you?"
I took it, and looked at the label. "Color proofs from the repro house," yawn. She must have been looking at my face because she laughed.
"Nothing very exciting, then?"
"Hardly." After I'd signed the delivery note, I looked up at her. She was still smiling, I think, though it was difficult to tell. Her face looked as if it always was.
"Well," she said, "I can either go straight to Peckham to pick up something else at store, or you can tell me about the telecommunications features."
Very surprised, I stared at her for a moment, then stepped back to let her in.
"Bastards,"
she said indignantly, when I told her about the things that hadn't been shipped with the machine, and she looked genuinely annoyed. I told her about the telecom stuff anyway, as we sat on the sofa and drank coffee. Mainly we just chatted, but not for very long, and when she got to the end of the road on her bike she turned and waved before turning the corner. That night Nancy went to Sainsbury's on the way home from work. I caught her eye as she unpacked the biscuits and brownies, potato chips and pastries, but she just stared back at me, and I looked away. She was having a hard time at work. Deflecting my gaze to the window, I noticed the dark cat was sitting on the wall opposite. It wasn't doing much, simply peering vaguely this way and that, watching things I couldn't see. It seemed to look up at the window for a moment, but then leaped down off the wall and wandered away down the street. I cooked dinner and Nancy didn't eat much, but she stayed in the kitchen when I went into the living room to finish off a job. When I made our cups of tea to drink in bed, I noticed that the bin had been emptied, and the gray bag stood, neatly tied, to one side. When I nudged it with my foot, it rustled, full of empty packets. Upstairs, the bathroom door was pulled shut, and the key turned in the lock. I saw Alice a few more times in the next few weeks. A couple of major jobs were reaching crisis point at the same time, and there seemed to be a semi-constant flurry of bikes coming up to the house. On three or four of those occasions, it was Alice whom I saw when I opened the door. Apart from one, when she had to turn straight around on pain of death, she came in for a coffee each time. We'd chat about this and that, and when the voice recognition software finally arrived, I showed her how it worked. I had a rip-off copy from a friend who'd sourced it from the States. You had to do an impersonation of an American accent to get the machine to understand anything you said, and my attempts to do so made Alice laugh a lot, which is curious, because it made Nancy merely sniff and ask me whether I'd put the new computer on the insurance. Nancy was having a bit of a hard time those couple of weeks. Her so-called boss was dumping more and more responsibility onto her, while stalwartly refusing to give her more credit. Nancy's world was very real to her, and she relentlessly kept me up to date on it. The doings of her boss were more familiar to me by then than the activities of most of my friends. She got her company car upgraded, which was a nice thing. She screeched up to the house one evening in something small and red and sporty, and hollered up to the window. I scampered down and she took us hurtling around North London, driving with her customary verve and confidence. On impulse, we stopped at an Italian restaurant we sometimes went to, and they miraculously had a table. Over coffee, we took each other's hands and said we love one another, which we hadn't done for a while. When we parked outside the house, I saw the dark cat sitting under a tree on the other side of the street. I pointed it out to Nancy, but as I've said, she doesn't really like cats, and merely shrugged. She went in first, and as I turned to close the door, I saw the cat was still sitting there, a black shape in the half-light. I wondered who it belonged to, and wished that it was ours. A couple of days later, I was walking down the street in the late afternoon, when I noticed a motorbike parked outside Sad Cafe. I seemed to have become sensitized to bikes over the previous few weeks, probably because I'd used so many couriers. Sad wasn't the cafe's real name, but what Nancy and I used to call it, when we used to traipse hungover down the road on Sunday mornings on a quest for a cooked breakfast. The first time we'd slumped over a formica table in there, we had been slowly surrounded by middle-aged men in zip-up jackets and beige bubble hats, a party of mentally subnormal teenagers with broken glasses, and old women on the verge of death. The pathos attack we'd suffered had nearly finished us off, and it had been Sad Cafe ever since. We hadn't been there in a while. Nancy usually had work in the evenings in those days, even at weekends, and fried breakfasts appeared to be off the map again. The bike resting outside made me glance inside the window, and with a shock of recognition I saw Alice in there, sitting at a table, nursing a mug of something or other. I nearly walked on, but then thought, what the hell, and stepped inside. Alice looked startled to see me, but then relaxed, and I sat down and ordered a cup of tea. She'd finished for the day, it turned out, and was killing time before heading off for home. I was at a loose end myself. Nancy was out for the evening, entertaining clients. It was very odd seeing Alice for the first time outside the flat, and strange seeing her not in working hours. Possibly it was that which made the next thing coalesce in front of us. Before we knew how the idea had arisen, we were wheeling her bike down the road to prop it up outside the Bengal Lancer, Kentish Town's bravest stab in the direction of a decent restaurant. I loitered awkwardly to one side while she stood in the street, took off her leathers, and packed them into the bike's carrier. She was wearing jeans and a green sweatshirt underneath, a green that matched her eyes. Then she ran her hands through her hair, saying,
"Close enough for rock and roll,"
and strode toward the door. Momentarily reminded of Nancy's standard hour and a half preparation before going out, I followed her into the restaurant. We took our time and had about four courses, and by the end we were absolutely stuffed. We talked of things beyond computers and design, but I can't remember what. We had a bottle of wine, a gallon of coffee, and smoked most of a packet of cigarettes. When we were done, I stood outside again, more relaxed this time, and she climbed back into her work clothes. She waved as she rode off, and I watched her go, and then turned and walked for home. It was a nice meal. It was also a big mistake. The next time I rang for a bike, I asked for Alice by name. After that, It seemed the natural thing to do. Alice also seemed to end up doing more of the deliveries to me. More than you could put down to chance. If we hadn't gone for that meal, perhaps it wouldn't have happened. Nothing was said, and no glances exchanged. I didn't note the date in my diary. But we were falling in love. The following night, Nancy and I had a row, the first full-blown one in a while. We rarely argued. She was a good manager. This one was short, and also very odd. It was quite late, and I was sitting in the lounge trying to work up the energy to turn on the television. I didn't have much hope for what I would find on it, but was too tired to read. I'd been listening to music before, and was staring at the stereo, half mesmerized by the green and red points of LEDs. Nancy was working at the table in the kitchen, which was dark apart from the lamp that shed yellow light over her papers. Suddenly she marched into the living room, already at maximum temper, and shouted incoherently at me. Shocked, I half stood, brow furrowed as I tried to work out what she was saying. In retrospect, I was probably slightly asleep, and her anger frightened me with its harsh intensity, seeming to fill the room. She was shouting at me for getting a cat. There was no point me denying it, because she'd seen it. She'd seen the cat under the table in the kitchen. It was in there still, and I was to go and throw it out. I knew how much she disliked cats, and anyway, how could I do it without asking her, and the whole thing was a classic example of what a selfish and hateful man I was. It took me a while to get to the bottom of this and start denying it. I was too baffled to get angry. In the end, I went with her into the kitchen and looked under the table. By then, I was getting a little spooked, to be honest. We also looked in the hallway, the bedroom, and the bathroom. Then we looked in the kitchen again, and in the living room. There was, of course, no cat. I sat Nancy on the sofa and brought in a couple of hot drinks. She was still shaking, though her anger was gone. I tried to talk to her, to work out what exactly was wrong. Her reaction was disproportionate, misdirected. I'm not sure even she knew what it was about. The cat, of course, could have been nothing more than a discarded shoe seen in near darkness, maybe even her own foot moving in the darkness. After leaving my parents' house, where there has always been a cat, I'd often startle myself by thinking I saw them in similar ways. She didn't seem especially convinced, but did calm down a little. She was so timid and quiet, and as always I found it difficult to reconcile her, as she was then, with her as corporate woman, as she was for so much of the time. I turned the fire on and we sat in front of it and talked, and even discussed her eating. Nobody else knew about that, apart from me. I didn't understand it, not really. I sensed that it was something to do with feelings of lack of control, of trying to shape herself and her world, but couldn't get much closer than that. There appeared to be nothing I could do except listen, but I suppose that was better than nothing. We went to bed a little later and made careful, gentle love. As she relaxed towards sleep, huddled in my arms, I caught myself for the first time feeling for her something that was a little like pity. Alice and I had dinner again about a week later. This time it was less of an accident, and took place farther from home. I had an early evening meeting in town, and by coincidence Alice would be in the area at around about the same time. I told Nancy I might end up having dinner with my client, but she didn't seem to hear. She was preoccupied, some new power struggle at work edging toward resolution. Though it was several weeks since the previous occasion, it didn't feel at all strange seeing Alice in the evening. Not least because we'd talked to each other often in the meantime. She'd started having two cups of coffee rather than one each time she'd dropped something off, and had once phoned me for advice on computers. She was thinking of getting one herself. I wasn't really sure what for. While it didn't feel odd, I was aware of what I was doing, meeting another woman for dinner, basically, and looking forward to it. When I talked to her, my feelings and what I did seemed more important, as if they were a part of someone worth talking to. Some part of me felt that it was more important than a little economy with the truth. To be honest, I tried not to think too hard about it. When I got home, Nancy was sitting in the living room reading.
"How was your meeting?"
she asked. "Fine," I replied. "Fine."
"Good,"
she said, and then went back to scanning her magazine. I could have tried to make conversation, but knew it would have come out tinny and forced. In the end, I went to bed and lay tightly curled on my side, wide awake. I was just drifting off to sleep when I heard a low voice in the silence, speaking next to my ear.
"Go away," it said. "Go away."
I opened my eyes, expecting I don't know what. Nancy's face, I suppose, hanging over mine. There was no one there. I was relaxing slightly, prepared to believe it had been a fragment of a dream, when I heard her voice again, saying the same words in the same low tone. Carefully, I climbed out of bed and crept toward the kitchen. Through it, I could see into the living room, where Nancy was standing in front of the main window in the darkness. She was looking out at something in the street.
"Go away," she said again softly.
I turned round and went back to bed. A couple of weeks passed. Time seemed to do that autumn. I was very immersed, what with one thing and another. Each day held something that fixed my attention and pulled me through it. I'd look up, and a week would have gone by without me having barely noticed. One of the things that held my attention, and became a regular part of most days, was talking to Alice. We talked about things that Nancy and I never touched upon, things Nancy simply didn't understand or care about. Alice read, for example. Nancy read, too, in that she studied memos and reports and boned up on the current corporate claptrap being imported from the States. She didn't read books, though, or paragraphs, even. She read sentences to strip from them what she needed to do her job, find out what was on television, or hold her own on current affairs. Every sentence was a bullet point, and she read to acquire information. Alice read for its own sake. She wrote, too, hints her a growing interest in computers. I mentioned once that I had written a few articles years back, before I settled on being a barely competent graphic designer instead. She said she'd written some stories and, after a regular nagging from me, diffidently gave me copies. I didn't know anything about fiction from a professional point of view, so I don't know how innovative or clever they were, but they gripped my attention, and I read them more than once, and that's good enough for me. I told her so, and she seemed pleased. We spoke most days and saw each other a couple of times a week. She delivered things to me or picked them up, and sometimes I chanced by Sag Cafe when she was sipping a cup of tea. It was all very low-key, very friendly. Nancy and I got on with each other, in an occasional space-sharing sort of way. She had her friends and I had mine. Sometimes we saw them together and performed as a social pair. We looked good together, like a series of stills from a lifestyle magazine. Life, if that's what it was, went on. Her eating vacillated between not good and bad, and I carried on being bleakly accepting of the fact that there didn't seem much I could do to help. So much of our lives seemed geared up to perpetuating her idea of how two young people should live, that I somehow didn't feel that I could call our bluff, point out what was living beneath the stones in our house. I also didn't mention the night I'd seen her in the lounge. There didn't seem any way of bringing it up. Apart from having Alice to chat with, the other good news was the new cat in the neighborhood. When I glanced out of the living room window sometimes, it would be there, ambling smoothly past or plonked down on the pavement, watching movement in the air. It had a habit of sitting in the middle of the road, daring traffic to give it any trouble, as if the cat knew what the road was for, but was having no truck with it. This was a field once, the twitch of her tail seemed to say, and as far as I'm concerned, it still is. One morning I was walking back from the corner shop, clutching some cigarettes and milk, and came upon the cat, perched on a wall. If you like cats, there's something rather depressing about having them run away from you, so I approached cautiously. I wanted to get to at least within a yard of this one before it went shooting off into hyperspace. To my delight, it didn't move away at all. When I got up next to her, she stood up, and I thought that was it, but it turned out to be just a recognition that I was there. She was quite happy to be stroked, and to have the fur on her head rumpled, and responded to having her chest rubbed with a purr so deep it was almost below the threshold of hearing. Now that I was closer, I could see the chestnut gleams in the dark brown of her fur. She was a very beautiful cat. After a couple of minutes of this, I moved away, thinking I ought to get on, but the cat immediately jumped off the wall and wove in figure eights about my feet, pressing up against my calves. I find it difficult enough to walk away from a cat at the best of times. When they're being ultra-friendly is impossible. So I bent down and tickled, and talked fond nonsense. I finally got to my door and looked back to see her, still sitting on the pavement. She was looking around as if wondering what to do next, after all that excitement. I had to fight down the impulse to wave. I closed the door behind me, feeling for a moment very lonely, and then went back upstairs to work. Then one Friday night, Alice and I met again, and things changed. Nancy was out at yet another work get-together. Her organization seemed to like running the social lives of its staff, like some rabid church, intent on infiltrating every activity of its disciples. Nancy mentioned the event in a way that made it clear that my attendance was far from mandatory, and I was quite happy to oblige. I do my best at these things, but doubt I look as if I'm having the time of my life. I didn't have anything else on, so I just flopped about the house for a while, reading and watching television. It was easier to relax when Nancy wasn't there, and we weren't busy being a couple. I couldn't settle, though. I kept thinking how pleasant it would be not to feel that way, that it would be nice to want your girlfriend to be home so you could laze about together. It didn't work that way with Nancy, not anymore. Getting her to consider a lie-in on one particular Saturday was a major project in itself. I probably hadn't tried very hard in a while either. She got up, I got up. I've been developed as a human resource. My reading grew fitful, and in the end I grabbed my coat and went for a walk down streets that were dark and cold. A few couples and lone figures floated down the roads in mid-evening transit between pubs and Chinese restaurants. The very formlessness of the activity around me, its random wandering, made me feel quietly content. The room in which Nancy and her colleagues stood, robotically passing business catchphrases up and down the hierarchy, leapt into my mind, though I'd no idea where it was. I thought quietly to myself that I would much rather be here than there. Then for a moment, I felt the whole of London spread out around me, and my contentment faded away. Nancy had somewhere to go. All I had was miles of finite roads and winter light, black houses leaning in toward each other. I could walk, and I could run, and in the end I would come to the boundaries, the edge of the city. When I reached them, there would be nothing I could do except turn around and come back into the city. I couldn't feel anything beyond the gates, couldn't believe anything was there. It wasn't some yearning for the countryside or far climes. I like London, and the great outdoors irritates me. It was more a sense that a place that should hold endless possibilities had been tamed by something, bleached out by my lack of imagination, by the limits of my life. I headed down the Kentish Town Road toward Camden, so wrapped up in heroic melancholy that I nearly got myself run over at the junction with Prince of Wales Road. Rather shaken, I stumbled back onto the curb, dazed by a passing flash of yellow light and a blurred obscenity. Fuck that, I thought, and crossed at a different place, sending me down a different road, toward a different evening. Camden was as ever, trying to prove that there was still a place for hippie throwback losers in the 1990s, and I skirted the purposeful crowds and ended up in a back road instead. And it was there that I saw Alice. When I saw her, I felt my heart lurch, and I stopped in my tracks. She was walking along the road, dressed in a long skirt and dark blouse, hands in pockets. She appeared to be alone, and was wandering down the street much as I was, looking around but in a world of her own. It was too welcome a coincidence not to take advantage of, and, careful not to surprise her, I crossed the road and met her on the other side. We spent the next 3 hours in a noisy, smoky pub. The only seats were very close together, crowded round one corner of a table in the center of the room. We drank a lot, but the alcohol didn't seem to function in the way it usually did. I didn't get drunk, but simply felt warmer and more relaxed. The reeling crowds of locals gave us ample ammunition to talk about, until we were going fast enough not to need any help at all. We just drank and talked and drank, and the bell for last orders came as a complete surprise. When we walked out of the pub, some of the alcohol kicked suddenly in, and we stumbled in unison on an unexpected step, to fall together, laughing and shing. Without even discussing it, we knew that neither of us felt like going home yet. And we ended up down by the canal instead. We walked slowly past the backs of houses and speculated what might be going on beyond the curtains. We looked up at the sky and pointed out stars. We listened to the quiet splashes of occasional ducks coming into land. After about 15 minutes, we We found a bench and sat down for a cigarette. When she put her lighter back in her pocket, Alice's hand fell near mine. I was very conscious of it being there, of the smallness, of the distance mine would have to travel. And I smoked left-handed so as not to move it. I wasn't forgetting myself. I still knew Nancy existed, knew how my life was set up. But I didn't move my hand. Then, like a chess game of perfect simplicity and naturalness, the conversation took us there. I said that work seemed to be slackening off after the busy period of the last couple of months. Alice said that she hoped it didn't drop off too much, so that I can continue to afford expensive computers that don't do quite what I expect, I asked.
No,
she replied.
So that I can keep coming to see you.
I turned and looked at her. She looked nervous but defiant, and her hand moved the inch that put it on top of mine.
You might as well know,
she said,
if you don't already. There are three important things in my life at the moment. My bike, my stories, and you.
People don't change their lives. Evenings do. They are nights that have their own momentum, their own purpose and agenda. They come from nowhere and take people with them. That's why you can never understand, the next day, quite how you came to do what you did, because it wasn't you who did it. It was the evening. My life stopped that evening and started up again, and everything was a different color. We sat on the bench for another 2 hours, wrapped up close to each other. We admitted when we'd first thought about each other, and laughed quietly about the distance we'd kept. After weeks of denying what I felt, of simply not realizing, I couldn't let go of her hand now that I had it. It felt so extraordinary to be that close to her, to feel the texture of her skin on mine and her nails against my palm. People change when you get that near to them, become much more real. If you're already in love with them, then they expand to fill the world. In the end, we got on to Nancy. We were bound to, sooner or later. Alice asked how I felt about her, and I tried to explain, tried to understand myself. In the end, we let the topic lapse. It's not going to be easy, I said, squeezing her hand. I was thinking glumly to myself that it might not happen at all. Knowing the way Nancy would react, it looked like a very high mountain to climb. Alice glanced at me and then turned back toward the canal. A big cat was sitting there, peering out over the water. First moving myself even closer to Alice, so that strands of her hair tickled against my face, I made a noise at the cat. It turned to look at us, and then ambled over toward the bench. I do like a friendly cat, I said, reaching out to stroke its head. Alice smiled and then made a noise of her own. I was a bit puzzled that she wasn't looking at the cat when she made it, until I saw that another was making its way out of the shadows. This one was smaller and more lithe, and walking right up to the bench. I was, I suppose, still a little befuddled with drink, and when Alice turned to look in a different direction, it took me a moment to catch up. A third cat was coming down the canal walk in our direction, followed by another. When a fifth emerged from the bushes behind our bench, I turned and stared at Alice. She was already looking at me, a smile on her lips like the first one of hers I'd seen. She laughed at the expression on my face, and then made her noise again. The cats around us sat to attention, and two more appeared from the other direction, almost trotting in their haste to join the collection. We were now so outnumbered that I felt rather beset. When the next one appeared, I had to ask, Alice, what's going on? She smiled very softly like a painting, and leaned her head against my shoulder.
A long time ago,
she said, as if making up a story for a child.
None of this was here. There was no canal, no streets and houses, and all around was trees and grass.
One of the cats round the bench briefly licked one of its paws, and I saw another couple padding out of the darkness toward us.
The big people had changed all of that. They've cut down the trees and buried the grass, and they've even leveled the ground. There used to be a hill here, a hill that was steep on one side, but gentle on the other. They've taken all that away and made it look like this. It's not that it's so bad. It's just different. The cats still remember the way it was.
It was a nice story, and yet another indication of how we thought in the same way. But it couldn't be true, and it didn't explain all the cats around us. There were now about 20, and somehow that was too many. Not for me, but for common sense. Where the hell were they all coming from? But they didn't have cats in those days, I said nervously. Not like this. This kind of cat is modern, surely. An import, or crossbreed. She shook her head.
That's what they say, she said. And that's what people think. They've always been here. It's just that people haven't always known.
Alice, what are you talking about? I was beginning to get really spooked by the number of cats milling softly around. They were still coming, in ones and twos, and now surrounded us for yards around. The stretch of canal was dark apart from soft glints of moonlight off the water, and the lines of the banks and walkways seemed somehow stark, sketched out, as if modeled on a computer screen. They'd been rendered well and looked convincing, but something wasn't quite right about the way they set together, as if some angle was 1 degree out.
1,000 years ago, cats used to come to this hill, because it was their meeting place. They would come and discuss their business, and then they would go away. This was their place, and it still is, but they don't mind us.
Why?
Because I love you, she said,
and kissed me for the first time. It was 10 minutes before I looked up again. Only 2 cats were left. I pulled my arm tighter around Alice and thought how simply and unutterably happy I was. Was that all true? I asked, pretending to be a child.
No, she said,
and smiled.
It was just a story.
She pushed her nose up against mine and nuzzled, and our heads melted into one. At 2 o'clock I realized I was going to have to go home, and we got up and walked slowly back to the road. I waited shivering with her for a minicab, and endured the driver's histrionic sighing as we said goodbye. I stood on the corner and waved until the cab was out of sight, and then turned and walked home. It wasn't until I turned into our road and saw that the lights were still on in our house that I realized just how real the evening had been. As I walked up the steps, the door opened. Nancy stood there in a dressing gown, looking angry and frightened.
"Where the hell have you been?"
she said. I straightened my shoulders and girded myself up to lie. I apologized. I told her I'd been out drinking with Howard, lying calmly and with a convincing determination. I didn't even feel bad about it, except in a self-serving academic sort of way. Some switch had been finally thrown in my mind, and as we lay in bed afterward, I realized that I wasn't in bed with my girlfriend anymore. There was just someone in my bed. When Nancy rolled toward me, her body open in a way that suggested she might not be thinking of going to sleep, I felt my chest tighten with something that felt like dread. I found a way of suggesting that I might be a bit drunk for anything other than unconsciousness, and she curled up beside me and went to sleep instead. I lay awake for an hour, feeling as if I were lying on a slab of marble in a room open to the sky. Breakfast the next morning was a festival of leaden politeness. The kitchen seemed very bright, and noise rebounded harshly off the walls. Nancy was in a good mood, but there was nothing I could do except smile tight smiles and talk much louder than usual, waiting for her to go to work. The next 10 days were both dismal and the best days of my life. Alice and I managed to see each other every couple of days, occasionally for an evening, but more often just for a cup of coffee. We didn't do any more than talk, and hold hands and sometimes kiss. Our kisses were brief, the kind of sketching out of the way things could be. Bad starts always undermine a relationship, for fear it could happen again. So we were restricted and honest with each other, and it was wonderful, but it was also difficult. Being home was no fun at all. Nancy hadn't changed, but I had, and so I didn't know her anymore. It was like having a complete stranger living in your house, a stranger who was all the worse for reminding you of someone you once loved. The things that were the closest to the way they used to be were the things that made me most irritable, and I found myself avoiding anything that might promote them. Something had to be done, and it had to be done by me. The problem was gearing myself up to it. Nancy and I had been living together for 4 years. Most of our friends assumed we'd be engaged before long. I'd already heard a few jokes. We knew each other very well, and that does count for something. As I moved warily around Nancy during those weeks, trying not to seem too close, I was also conscious of how much we had shared together, of how affectionate a part of me still felt toward her. She was a friend, and I cared about her. I didn't want her to be hurt. My relationship with Nancy wasn't completely straightforward. I wasn't just her boyfriend, I was her brother and father, too. I knew some of the reasons her eating was as bad as it was. Things no one else would ever know. I talked it through with her. I knew how to live with it. Knew how to not make her feel any worse. She needed support, and I was the only person there to give it. Ripping that away when she was already having such a bad time would be very difficult to forgive. And so things went on, for a little while. I saw Alice when I could, but always in the end I would have to go, and we would part. And each time it felt more and more arbitrary, and I found it harder to remember why I should have to leave. I grew terrified of saying her name in my sleep, or of letting something slip, and felt as if I were living my life on stage in front of a predatory audience waiting for a mistake. I go out for walks in the evening and walk as slowly up the road as possible, stopping to talk to the cat, stroking her for as long as she liked and walking up and down the pavement with her, doing anything to avoid going back into the house. I spent most of the second week looking forward to the Saturday. At the beginning of each week, Nancy announced she would be going on a team-building day at the weekend. She explained to me what was involved, the chasm of evangelical corporate vacuity into which she and her colleagues were cheerfully leaping. She was talking to me a lot more at the time, wanting to share her life. I tried, but I couldn't really listen. All I could think about was that I was due to be driving up to Cambridge that day, to drop my work off at a client's. I'd assumed that I'd be going alone.